Good afternoon. Welcome to session 4G. Is super always the best option? We are fortunate to have Aaron and Tim, who I'll introduce momentarily, to present this session. I'm Peter Martin, by the way, chairing this session. The usual format, 50 minutes is the length of the session. Presentations will run for perhaps 30 to 40, and then questions. Remember to fill in your feedback surveys, and of course, if you ask a question, identify yourself at the microphone, and we'll go from there. So, Aaron is going to speak first. Dr. Aaron Bruhn from ANU, senior lecturer in actuarial studies out there. Prior to that, did some work in the life insurance field. For those of you who don't know Aaron, he's a pretty good guy. The only minor issue, I guess, is that he's a Kiwi, so we'll hold that against him. And Dr. Tim Higgins, also a senior lecturer at the ANU, has done a lot of work in the area of income contingent loans in recent years. His career highlight obviously was a period in the Australian Government Actuaries Office in the early sort of 2000s. So we're going to start with Aaron, and then we'll go straight to Tim without any interruptions.
It's the Trans-Tasman operation here. The New Zealander here with Tim, the fine Australian to follow. So life in Canberra is obviously a fairly leisurely thing. We have time there to sit back and talk and think about things which may be useful or not may be useful. So Tim and I and others, we sort of chew the fat, so to speak, now and again, and get some ideas and think about things, how they work. And one such idea was, I guess, a bit of a, not suspicion, but a bit of a thought around what's the super thing all about, and is super that super when there's other alternatives for what's essentially your money as well. So this is the outcome of one of those discussions, and the middle author, Ruchin Han, he did a lot of the early modelling work and thought into this. He was our honours student that we had jointly supervised last year. Tim would agree, I think, that we're quite open to questions during the time, but if the easy questions, can you send them to me? If the hard questions, Tim's your man. So, anyway, so I guess to set the motivation overall of what we're looking at here, if we take a look at the super system as it currently stands, two things sort of come to mind. One is that for a period of time, we're told what we should be doing in the accumulation phase, to use industry speak. So we're sort of compelled at some step for a certain period of time to do a certain thing, which is put aside money that is actually yours, but we're told to accumulate it. Then at some stage, that compulsion goes out the door and you're told to do what you like effectively later on in life. So that's not meant to be that loaded. The loadedness of that comes later on in another topic perhaps. And I guess there is a philosophical thing here of, you know, is the nature of compulsion then not compulsion versus compel or not compel throughout life? Are they better approaches philosophically? And we can talk about that maybe another time. But in the meantime, this sort of pattern of things leads us to two things, or a couple of things, observations in the meantime. I guess the first thing is what's the overall aim of compulsion in the accumulation phase? And quite obviously, you know, it's a good thing to save money as much as we can. And the compulsion aspect, I guess, primarily is there to overcome the apparent, myopia or reluctance of people to save who might not otherwise save. So we can talk about retirement savings increasing, or we can talk about this thing called net wealth or your own financial position improving too. And I guess one question we've asked is, are these the same thing? And of course they're not. They are different things. Retirement savings is really, or at least through super, is just a subset of what your overall financial position is or could be. So saying they're not the same thing, leads us to two things. One is obviously the subset issue. Another one is to highlight that compulsion in itself does have an opportunity cost. And one obvious one, and it's just one, is, you know, it's your money effectively, so is one alternative use to reduce debts that you might have. And I will just point out at this stage, we do actually say in our, to all our Part 2 students, and the Institute effectively says it in our Part 2 textbook, Chapter 4, Anthony Ash's chapter, as Anthony's here, no. You know, we do say it's reasonable common sense in general for a lot of people to reduce debt before doing other stuff. You know, debt, assets, reduce debt, increase assets after. Of course, it's not always the way things work, and it's definitely not the case here when people would have debt and super savings as well. Nick Xenophon, amongst many others too, for maybe for various reasons, they are querying this compulsion element as well. But overall, I guess it's a common sense thing for a lot of people to reduce debt before you consider doing other things. So our question really is, how significant is this opportunity cost? I guess we're going to caution here and say it really is just a work in progress. The question we're asking is, if this opportunity can be represented by diverting superannuation guarantee payments from your employer, rather than going to a super fund, if we can divert them into a household debt that I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, around half Australians might have, called a home mortgage, what does someone's position look like down the track? This is not the same as accessing super for a super on steroids first home buyer's grant or anything. Okay, we're not talking about that. We're talking about existing debts for people. Is this a suitable, appropriate, reasonable use of your money in the meantime? Okay, so a couple of things we do. What we do is just look at using historic data to look at the current system. So assuming 9.5% is the SG contributions made, business as usual into superannuation with your non-super money, your base salary, you're taking out whatever you need to take out after tax to pay a mortgage. We assume certain mortgages and certain incomes, all that sort of stuff. And pay that off as much as we can. Option two is, for a period of time, why not take that superannuation guarantee, that 9.5%, that's your part of your pay, it's your money, off that 9.5%, take off your marginal income rate. So obviously you might say not tax efficient. Yep, that's true in that sense. But take that money off, take that money and divert that to the mortgage in the meantime. So, you know, you've got a bigger mortgage payment going on under option two than you do under option one. And then at some stage, when that mortgage is paid off under option two, the superannuation guarantee goes back to being super, as well as your mortgage payments. But it's all apples for apples, effectively, because what we're saying is, under both options, option one, the current system, option two, just what we're proposing, a simple wee diversion of super into your mortgage. Let's look at the outcomes at age 60 under both options. Assume retirement age and access to super occurs at that time. We're talking about apples for apples throughout. You've got the same disposable income throughout the whole thing. And under both options, though, once the mortgage is paid off, the salary that you're using to pay off that mortgage in both cases goes towards super under both concessional and then non-concessional arrangements as much as you can do. But of course, under option two, your contributions are that much higher after the mortgage is paid off, because now you're diverting your mortgage payments earlier to super. Okay. Is that clear enough, hopefully? Yep, hopefully all reasonably straightforward. So obviously contributions can be concessional or non-concessional. We'll give a nod to the economists here and say people are reasonably rational, hopefully, in this sense. You're going to contribute to super if you can, if it's tax advantage after debt is removed. We make assumptions around the current the current superannuation cap for concessional contributions at $30,000. It doesn't make sense in the long term not to increase that with AWE, so we do that. And obviously you're contributing as much as you can at the right time later on, and concessional first and then non-concessional after. Okay, so what's the main outputs we're looking? Well, here we want to compare your wealth. So how are you actually doing at age 60? Again, of which superannuation is one component. Okay, so it's just the one piece of the pie. And we're just defining that net wealth to be what you have in super because of the tax advantage nature of it, minus any debts you may be owing, namely the mortgage at this point in time. We're going to ignore the age pension factor, okay, just for now, but there's an important implication of that, of course, which is the differences it leads to in the fiscal position of government, and Tim will touch on this later on as well. Other things that pop out, just to have a wee look at them, difference in the actual tax take over time, aside from age pension costs, but the actual difference in tax take from both superannuation and income tax to government, and primarily to, of course, the difference in loan interest paid for both options. Okay, what would you expect? Well, quite obviously, if we're diverting super into the mortgage for a period of time, you're going to expect a reduced term of mortgage in option two. No, it's a no-brainer there, unless you're making negative payments, which we're not assuming here, drawing on it continually, which we're not going to do. The mortgage comes down, so there's going to be savings on your mortgage from a lower overall accrual of interest. In the time, of course, your mortgage is being paid under option two, the option we're proposing, not necessarily as policy, but just as a framework to think about such things. There's no growth in super other than investment earnings if the starting super balance is non-zero. And after the mortgage is repaid, of course, you get the super contributions from your previous mortgage payments plus the super itself. So I guess this leads into what's the better option in terms of net financial position? You know, is it to reduce a debt first and then throw everything you can into super? Or is it to do the two concurrently, which is the current system, despite all the, I guess, cash flow pressures and all the rest that families may have? Okay, and of course there's a whole lot of variables here. It depends critically on all these things, the main one being the difference between mortgage rates and super returns, but also salary age, mortgage term, mortgage size, and other things as well. Okay, that's just a brief overview, and Tim will jump up and tell you what we got to with it.
Right. Thanks, Aaron. So there's too many slides here given the time that I have available, so I am going to run through some of these very quickly. Well, you're not going to ring the bell. But the slides, I've been told, are going to be made available through the Institute, so you can look at these in your own time or come up to me and Aaron afterwards and have a chat. First, I'm going to try and consolidate what Aaron said about the methodology by taking you through a simple example. This is a person aged 25, starting gross salary. That looks small, $52,000, but that is the approximate full-time average salary for a 25-year-old. Now, by age 30, that is $60,000, and by age 35, it's $70,000 because of promotional increases. I'm just going to jump forward to this plot first, which shows income assumptions. This is from the 2011 census. We look at all percentiles of income from the 10th percentile to the 90th percentile for the sake of modelling, but this is just for illustration. And you can see this is in 2015/16 dollars, inflated up. But you can see for a 22-year-old, they start off on low salary, and then just from promotional increase, it moves up. This doesn't take into account productivity gains, but we do, of course, inflate with AWE for the purpose of projections. So that gives you a bit of a taste of the sort of typical income patterns in society. And as Aaron said, please, if any questions come up during the presentation, then by all means go ahead and ask. You got one? No, he's not looking happy. So home loan, we're going to assume $300,000, term of 30 years. And as Aaron said, this is going to be critically dependent on your assumptions about superannuation returns versus mortgage interest rates. For this example, for illustration of the methodology, we're assuming balanced super returns of 5.1% per annum and mortgage rates of 7.6%. Now, that might not look like the current reality, but those are the 20-year historic rates, or thereabouts. Sure, mortgage rates are lower now, but that's around the 20-year average.
Allocation
balanced. Yeah. It includes the GFC, of course. You take the GFC out and the super returns are going to go up a little bit, but we take that into account in some of the modelling that we do as well. Quarterly repayment, if you look at 30-year term and a home loan of $300,000 and those interest rates, the quarterly repayment to amortise that mortgage works out at about $6,200. Now, what I'm going to do is skip the numbers here in the interest of time and go to some plots which better illustrate... more efficiently illustrate what we're talking about. So this gives you a snapshot every 10th quarter, and we've got 140 quarters here because we've got 30 years until the mortgage is repaid, until the person turns 60 or thereabouts. A snapshot every 10th quarter from age 25 to 60, again thereabouts, of current arrangements. And the y-axis, the bar plots in total represent the grossed up income. So it represents salary plus 9.5% of salary. Salary plus the SG. And what we can see here is that salary can be then decomposed into the various components. How is that salary effectively spent? Given that it's grossed up, including SG, 9.5% of salary goes on superannuation guarantee contributions, which is the orange slash yellow bars. The green is the base mortgage installments, which are level amounts of $6,200. Incidentally, this is in nominal dollars, which is why it goes up so dramatically, because salary is assumed to go up so dramatically. And then income tax comes out of salary. And again, salary goes up, so that goes up. And then we're left with disposable income. What's disposable income? It's just salary minus income, minus income tax, minus superannuation guarantee contributions. That's the current arrangement. This is what we're comparing it with. So under option two, again, grossed up income, the size of these bar charts are exactly the same as these. But for the first 70 quarters or so, we don't have any SG contributions because that amount that was originally contributed to the SG is now going to be used on mortgage repayments. Because it's used on mortgage repayments, the amount of SG, it was around $1,200 in that first quarter, for example, only $800 of that actually goes to pay the mortgage because a big chunk is taken off on income tax payments. We're assuming it's no longer taxed concessionally if it's used on the mortgage. As a consequence, the base mortgage installment is the same. There's an additional mortgage repayment, and the income tax take is slightly higher for those first 70 quarters here than there. You can see the blue. You can see these blue bars, or light blue bars, increase slightly when we go from option one to option two because of the extra tax. Disposable income, though, and this is the point of comparing apples with apples, remains the same for every quarter for the two options. And if you look at the dark blue, they're exactly the same level throughout. So what's changing? After the mortgage is paid off, well, in this first case, it takes about 120 quarters to pay off the mortgage, 30 years, I should say. Here, the additional mortgage repayments has the effect of reducing the mortgage term to 17 years from 30 years. That frees up additional, it frees up the base mortgage installment, which no longer needs to be repaid, and that can be paid as additional superannuation contributions. What's the magnitude of those additional superannuation contributions? Well, the choice of how much to contribute there is chosen such that the disposable income is the same under the two options. So, again, we can jump back and forth. You can see the dark blue stays the same. All that's happening is that additional mortgage repayment is directed to concessional contributions or non-concessional contributions. In this particular example, all of those extra contributions are concessional because they don't reach the concessional cap of $30,000 indexed, and as a consequence, the income tax that's payable is a lot lower because it reduces, it's effectively a salary sacrifice. So it reduces the income tax. And the million-dollar question, and intuitively in my mind, I thought, well, it probably isn't going to make too much difference, option two compared to option one. At the end of the day, it's probably going to be, you know, rounding error. Maybe it won't have an impact. But if the model is correct, and this is why we call this our preliminary results.
You have 12,000 going concessional each quarter. Increases by AWE.
Increases by AWE, yeah. Anyway, before I go on to the results, this is option one and option two compared, just bar on bar, and you can see that once the mortgage is paid off under option two, the superannuation guarantee kicks back in, the disposable income's the same. The only difference is where those SG contribute, those additional mortgage installments now go, and the mortgage installments now go into additional contributions, concessional or otherwise. So what does it actually look like from another perspective? The blue line is under current rules. The red line is under the proposed or option two. You can see that there's a 30-year repayment period for the mortgage. This is the right-hand plot. 17-year with the red line under the alternative. Under the alternative, of course, there's no superannuation contributions made, so our balance is zero up to the 17th year, and then it takes off because of the large magnitude of super contributions that are made. In this particular example, it crosses over and it results in a balance of around $200,000 more than we would get otherwise under the existing scheme. In real dollars, those two numbers equate to about $350,000 versus $450,000, or $100,000 better off if we could pay our mortgage off with our superannuation guarantee contributions. But that could immediately be criticised on the grounds that, well, we've just chosen a fixed gap between mortgage rates and superannuation returns. So what we did is try to look at this stochastically by looking at 20 years of quarterly superannuation balance returns and mortgage rates, and then rather than putting in parametric assumptions about the returns, say normally or log normally distributed, which implies all sorts of, well, we wanted to avoid assumptions. So what we thought is the best way to approach this is just to take the existing historic data and sample from that data. And sampling from existing data effectively is what bootstrapping is all about. You bootstrap from the data. And what we actually did here is used a block bootstrap approach, and that not only preserves correlation between the returns and the mortgage rate, so we were sampling, there's a correlation between a superannuation return and the corresponding mortgage rate during that quarter. We sampled both of those rates simultaneously from different quarters. But because there's also autocorrelation or serial correlation over time between mortgage interest rates, we also wanted to preserve that by sampling blocks over time. And that's called the block bootstrap. The question is, what should the block length be? Should it be a length of 1? Should it be a length of 40? And, you know, the jury is out on the best methodology to use there. So in the interests of, robustness, we chose a variety of block lengths ranging from 1 block length to 60 and showed through this whole process that it produces consistent results, not just on the best estimate of the difference in wealth between the options, but also the confidence intervals around those. And we carried out 1,000 simulations for each of these, mainly in the interest of time. Aaron and I were, running this simulation model over the last couple of days. We always leave everything to the last minute, which is why it's also called preliminary. So what do the results look like? Again, this is for a 25-year-old with a $300,000 mortgage, but now instead of assuming median income, we let income vary on the x-axis here. So that's the left side here is the 10th percentile of income. This is the 90th percentile. This is the 50th percentile of income. We don't assume variation over time with incomes, we assume someone at the 50th percentile stays at the 50th percentile and so on. So again, now, and this is in real dollars, so we've deflated that back to $2015 dollars. Blue is the current rules, and red is using the superannuation guarantee to repay the mortgage. And somewhat counterintuitively, it seems like the gap is pretty consistent across the different incomes. And it's large. It's larger than I was expecting. A question isn't just what is the best estimate, though. It's also what is the variability in the results, given that we are now simulating and we can get a measure of what that variability is because of the volatility in mortgage rates and superannuation returns. So this tells the same sort of results, same results for the same case, but this is the difference between those two lines, the difference between the red line and the blue line. That's the black line. And the dotted lines give the upper and lower deciles of the simulations. So in other words, out of those 1,000 simulations, 10% of them lay at or above that dotted line, and 10% lay at or below that dotted line. 80% lie within that range. And the somewhat surprising thing here is that despite all of that variability in interest rates and superannuation returns over a 20-year period, which is marked by some dramatic periods of volatility, we get a difference in wealth or relative benefit here that's quite substantial. Incidentally, there's a dip, as you can see here, and I'm not going to go into too much detail about that, but that's an artifact of the superannuation guarantee rules, the fact that if you have an income below $37,000 annually, you don't pay any contribution tax on that amount. And so the opportunity cost, therefore, of going to option two is much higher for that particular group. Any of you who are interested in the fine details of that, I can talk to you afterwards, but in the interest of time, just know that it's an artifact of the superannuation guarantee rules. Yeah.
Those people probably couldn't buy a house anymore.
Well, those people probably couldn't buy a house anyway, that's right. But another thing to keep in mind is we are just looking at this from the perspective of an individual. It's just one person. And you could consider, well, there might be two people in that couple, and only one of them is using their superannuation towards repayment of the mortgage, whereas the other one's income is effectively being used for disposable income and living costs. We haven't, again, this is preliminary work. We've been looking at it from the perspective of one individual as opposed to couples, and that could confuse things. The other point to mention here about this difference in wealth and the superannuation balance, again, we're not taking into account the age pension. And there, insofar that there is a higher superannuation balance there, that would reduce eligibility for the age pension, and so their net wealth position, the actual gap between this red line and blue line, would be expected to be lower as a consequence of different eligibility for the age pension. This is, again, the same results, but it's just the proportional increase in the superannuation balance. And it just illustrates the dramatic change on individual wealth that can arise if we could all access our superannuation guarantee and if we had the discipline to spend it in this way, more to the point, rather than going out and buying a flat-screen television. All right. I just wanted to highlight this slide as a separate slide to emphasise that difference, because this is a critical point in why this whole thing really works. The consequence of using the SG to pay more on your mortgage dramatically reduces the build-up of interest charge, which greatly reduces the time to repayment of the mortgage and consequently allows more to be invested in superannuation relatively early. So the gain to the individual by doing this is a direct loss to the banks. It's not such a bad thing. Implications to income tax and super tax revenue. There's also a potential loss to government here insofar that, early on in the piece, there would be additional tax revenue to government if the superannuation was not taxed at 15%, but it was taxed at income tax rates for a large portion of the income distribution curve. So early on, there might be greater tax take, but later on, the additional superannuation contributions under option two after the mortgage is paid off are very high, and there'll be tax consequences in the same way that there's tax consequences now because of the generous concessional tax scheme. But the amounts here are low in the scheme of things. If we look at the median here, that's $15,000, and that's compared to a tax take of around $350,000 for that individual in terms of income tax and superannuation tax. So we're only talking about a reduction of 4% in the tax take from government as a consequence of this. And importantly, not considered yet, is the fact that it would also lead to lower age pension outlays. So it could, in some circumstances, and Aaron and I have to crunch the numbers, it could lead to a situation where it's revenue neutral, potentially. So some might criticise this because of the GFC, and many may argue, well, you've looked at 20 years, but the GFC, 20 years of historic data, but the GFC is not a 1-in-20-year event, so you should probably exclude that. So we do exclude that just as a sensitivity test. And the black line is the line of difference in wealth that I previously showed. The red line is the same result excluding that GFC period. It definitely has an impact, but it lowers the difference in wealth from $100,000 to about $90,000. So still a very large impact. All right, what is the impact then? Because this is we specifically chose a 25-year-old with a $300,000 mortgage. What sort of variation results do we get if we consider different factors, if we allow the mortgage size to vary? And as expected, the greater size of the mortgage here, the greater the expected difference in wealth. But that said, even with a small mortgage, and again we've got the 10th and 90th deciles, the 1st and 9th decile here of the simulation results, even with a small mortgage, we're still getting a positive difference in wealth. This looks at it in a similar way, but we're, instead of just dealing with a 25-year-old and a $300,000 mortgage in a 30-year term, as we have here, we now consider, well, what would happen if that person had the option to contribute to their to use their superannuation guarantee for their mortgage, but they were already 5 years into their mortgage term. So their mortgage had reduced from $300,000 to $280,000. And these loan amounts here are based on the actual loan amount, or the approximate loan amount, 5 years on, 10 years on, 15, 20 years on, and so on. So if you start with a $300,000 loan with those, with the average interest rate, with the interest rates based on the simulated historic past, then for a 30-year-old, you have a lower mortgage, a lower term, still a positive relative benefit, a positive financial outcome from using the SG for the mortgage. Same for a 35-year-old and a 40-year-old. And even for a 45-year-old, and I'm not far away from that, I could still get some benefit. And frankly, although my age is here, my mortgage is more like this one. and interestingly, even the upper and lower deciles, the effective confidence intervals here, don't fall below zero. Other people could criticise this on the grounds that, sure, you've used historic patterns of mortgage interest rates and superannuation returns, but the past is no guide to the future. We all know that. So what happens if we're moving to a completely different sort of economic climate and the gap between investment returns and mortgage interest rates is shrinking considerably in the future? Now, I think all the evidence that I've read recently suggests that is not going to happen, and that, indeed, Long-term investment returns are probably going to be lower in the next 5 to 10 years than they have been in the past, again, excluding the GFC. And there is, of course, a risk, although mortgage rates are very low, there is a risk that those are going to increase, that we're getting to the bottom of that cycle. So if anything, perhaps the situation is going to get worse for investors, in which case the gap between the mortgage interest rate and the superannuation return, which is on the x-axis here, might move over towards the left. The 20-year historical average has a gap between mortgage rates and super returns of around 2.5%, just here. That's where that black line is. That's the $100,000 gap, or thereabout, for a median income earner. The blue line is 90th income percentile. The red line is 10th income percentile. And what it shows that even if we have the same long-term mortgage rates as superannuation returns, which I think is frankly inconceivable, but even if we were in that world, you would still be $50,000 better off in the long run if you could use your super to pay off your mortgage. And at 1.5%, the other way, where super returns exceed mortgage by 1.5%, you'd have to be in that situation for this not to pay off. Finally, another question could be, to what extent is this all driven, and are the results driven by the generous superannuation concession tax rules? The fact that we contribute at 15% rather than a marginal income tax rate. And we wanted to look at this for two reasons, to try and understand the mechanism behind why this works, but also in light of the discussion recently about the generosity of the concession rates and the possibility, albeit a distant one given the politics, of those concessional rates being removed. If we do remove them entirely, in other words, where our concessional cap is $0 rather than $30,000, we still get a positive result here. And remember, we're comparing apples with apples. So although removing the cap removes the ability to make concessional contributions from our income once we've paid the mortgage off, it also reduces the contributions and the balance of superannuation under the existing arrangements. So our superannuation balance under both arrangements would be much lower, but the gap is still substantial between them. This little drop here, again, this is an artifact of the system, of the scheme. If anyone's interested, you can always raise it as a question, but I won't start talking about it now because I could go on. This is for a median income earner. If we deal with an upper quartile income earner, this just has the effect of pushing that graph along so that trough there moves along slightly. So what is a summary of all of that? This is a way to wrap it up for the 25-year-old median full-time income earner. It leads to an approximate $100,000 increase in wealth in 2015 dollars, 30%, which is large in anyone's interpretation. The probability of increase is close to 100% if we assume that the future difference between mortgage rates and superannuation returns are consistent for the next 30 or 40 years as they have been for the last 20. There's a reduction in loan interest of $120,000, which really drives this whole thing. And the reduction in tax revenue of less than $15,000 and potentially closer to $0 if you factor in the age pension. And this is the media grab, in my view. Again, preliminary. The consequence of the current SG rules is greater profit for mortgage providers at the expense of retiree wealth. And sorry, Don, just before, this is all driven entirely by intellectual curiosity and the fact that Aaron and I both have very big mortgages. Should this... Oh, yeah, go on.
No, sorry.
Oh, okay, just last slide. Should the system be changed? Regardless of what the numbers say, we all see great policy ideas, but the political environment is the political environment, and moral hazard, and adverse selection, And, you know, you have the best of intentions and you make a little change and then you realise that it's caused much more damage than good. So what's the precedent? New Zealand, Singapore, China, Malaysia, they all allow some withdrawal or redirection of retirement savings for housing. The modelling, again, if it's correct, shows it's extremely welfare enhancing. And if the purpose of super is in to increase wealth and financial independence at retirement, then shouldn't the rules change if it means substantially better financial outcomes for retirees? And of course, the reality is there's huge barriers to any policy change. What would the impact be on the housing market if this went ahead? If people could repay their loans more quickly, then they would be more willing to borrow more, and we all know where that could lead. But you could also counter that by saying, well, the problems with the property market aren't policies like this, it's the fact that supply is so low compared to demand. But this is an immediate problem with... Again, Aaron and I aren't suggesting this is necessarily policy, but we're hopeful that commentators, rather than blindly arguing for higher SG, will consider the opportunity cost more so than they have done in the past. Would the SG be paid on the mortgage or spent on discretionary purposes? I know most of my friends, if I told them, you can take your SG out now and put it on your mortgage, they'll take it out and go on a holiday scheme in Switzerland or America and buy a television. And, you know, people don't think about the future. So the question in our mind is, could this somehow be used in some sort of way to improve the system? And that's an open question, and I'd be interested to hear everyone's thoughts.
Okay, great talk, Aaron and Tim. We've got about 5 minutes, so we're going to revert back to type and use the microphone now, John. I'm sorry, but
and tough questions question. To Aaron yeah. at the front. Yeah. Thanks.
Sorry, I think you were first, John. Tim, thanks for that very interesting talk. I just have one question, though. In about three or four slides from the end, you argued that historically on a 20-year average, the superannuation returns from balance fund had been 2.5% lower than mortgage rates. But if you look at the situation currently, I think, like I'm not an expert, but I think you can probably get 4.5% as a mortgage rate. Now, there's quite a lot of providers of account-based pensions, superannuation products in this room, and if you told them that they were not going to provide a return of more than 2% to investors, I think they'd be pretty horrified. I'm just interested in your comments.
Yeah, we are living in unusual economic times, and I think the likelihood of the current low mortgage interest rate environment and that gap persisting over the next 20 and 30 years, and this projection isn't for a 5-year period, it's for a 40-year period or 30-year period. Again, I take your point, and maybe we are moving into a different sort of economic environment. And that's the main reason that we wanted to include this plot to show where it works and where it doesn't work.
Just on that one too, actually, Tim pushed back at me on this one. I wouldn't actually be comparing it to a balance fund. I'd be comparing it to a cash account because that's the risk equivalent. I mean, your mortgage rate's guaranteed. Super's, you know, obviously a variable. So effectively, this would look even stronger if you compare it to historic cash returns or capital protection returns.
David Schneider, I'm from one of those Bastard super funds. In fact, I'm actually from your Bastard super fund, UniSuper.
I love my super fund.
Yeah, good. Good, yes, sir. We're proud to work there. Couple things. The first thing, just 2 points, actually. Expenses within super, you might not have included that. So there's actually a cost of managing your super account balance. And so that would probably knock off another 30, 40 basis points quite comfortably. So it makes the situation even more extreme. Yeah. And then the other point, which I wanted to raise, and you did actually touch on it in your concluding slide, if this policy was to be introduced, the impact would be higher and more volatile house prices. We're already in what I think is almost bubble territory. It puts more pressure on the financial system. But I did think this was very interesting research. Thank you.
G'day. Anthony Sleba, Ernst & Young. And I totally agree with that point earlier about comparing with a cash fund, because if you're looking at an individual's overall portfolio, you should be comparing apples with apples. My question, I've got a couple of questions. So firstly, do you assume that the mortgage is repaid at the age of 60 if there is a mortgage remaining?
In this particular case, with all the examples we've looked at, given we're dealing with a 30-year term, and even for older ages, a shorter term, the mortgage is paid off by age 55. So,
yeah, okay. So you haven't looked at the older cases?
We haven't needed to consider that.
Okay. And the other thing is, have you looked at a transitional strategy? Because some would argue paying off your debt first, and then there is a cutover point where you should actually swap it over into super, and you could potentially get more net wealth at retirement.
Oh, you mean not so not waiting until the mortgage is repaid entirely,
correct,
but trying to find an optimum?
Yeah.
No, we haven't. But that's
there is. It'd be good if you look into that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thanks.
Donald Campbell, the Heron Partnership. I too thought it was very interesting research. You noted with a smiley face that you've both got big mortgages.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that your mortgage is much bigger than the 45-year-old modelled. The data I've seen, which isn't a lot, but the data I have seen from banks and mortgage holdings suggests that people don't have one mortgage over their whole lifetime. They upsize their mortgage over their career as they get promotions, as they get bigger incomes. And a big part of that is the capital gains tax exemption on your house, on your primary residence, and also the exemption from the assets test. So there are big encouragements in our system currently to upsize your mortgage. So I'd be interested to see, I suspect you haven't done it as yet, but to see how this works on I suppose what I'd call a more realistic basis, where as your income increases and you pay down that first mortgage, you consider upsizing your mortgage and getting a bigger house.
Yeah, something that I certainly haven't considered. I mean, the reason we have considered in the modelling, I'm not going to upsize anyway. the reason we have big mortgages isn't because we've been upsizing, it's because we're academics and it just takes a long time. Thanks.
Can I just ask one quick one before we finish? Tim, could go back to the two slides. Keep going. This one. Yep. So did you do that one in conjunction with equalising the taxation arrangements?
Equalising the taxation?
Well, in other words, in my mind, it feels to me like that should be... if you had no difference in the tax arrangements, at 0% difference, it should be neutral.
Yeah, it's probably a good way to test the accuracy of the model to do that, but I haven't done that. Good idea.
Okay. Please thank Tim and Aaron for a great talk. And here's your take on too.